Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Author Chang-Rae Lee left Korea for America when he was 3 years old, but Korea never left him. Now, more than four decades later, he's made his mark as a best-selling author and narrator of the Korean-American experience and much more. In his latest novel, he goes big and back to Korea, to the Korean War, taking on global issues of war and its brutal weight on individuals, on love, on the human spirit. From 1930s China and 1950s Korea to New York and Italy in the 1980s, his new novel, The Surrendered, is an exploration of war and its aftermath. This hour, On Point novelist Chang-Rae Lee. You can join the conversation. From Korea to Iraq to Afghanistan, have you experienced what makes war's echo so long? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Chang-Rae Lee joins me now in the studio. He's the best-selling author of three previous novels, Native Speaker, A Gesture Life, and Aloft. A professor at Princeton University, his new novel is The Surrendered. The New York Times' Michiko Kakutani calls it a gripping and fiercely imagined work that burrows deep into the dark heart of war, leaving us with a choral portrait of the human capacity for both barbarism and transcendence. Chang-Rae Lee, welcome. It's great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Isn't it brave to take on war? War's been written about so much.
It has. Not so much the Korean War, actually. Of course, we know the Korean War, or we don't know the Korean War, as the Forgotten War. And even being Korean and growing up in my family, we never talked about the war. And so my parents, my father, of course, only mentioned it once, and partly an inspiration for a chapter in this book. But yeah, I was daunted by it. I mean, what we have is, you know, from my memory, is MASH and mm-hmm. some other TV shows and references. But so it was a vast empty canvas for me. And but the more that I did research, the more I looked into the characters that I was conceiving, some of the travels that I'd made, I realized, of course, that this was a very special story, but of course not a new one in many ways.
I had an uncle who lost a leg in the Korean War. I understand why he didn't like to talk about it. It's hard to be a farmer with one leg. But what about your family? Why wouldn't they have spoken about the Korean War?
Well, my father...
They were Koreans, Korean-Americans.
Yes. Yeah, my father was a young boy at the time. He was about 11 years old. He grew up in North Korea before the country was divided, and... Mm-hmm. On the eve of hostilities, his family was there. They were one of, you know, millions of refugees moving about the country, and many of whom were heading south. And during that journey, he and his brother were on top of a refugee train, not mm-hmm. inside, because the insides were so crowded. And
as boys, they were
as boys,
there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as it happened in the middle of one night, the train lurched, and his brother fell off, and he was run over by the wheels of the train and lost his leg and bled out. He died right there. Mm-hmm. And that's
were the parents around? Was there anyone
there
to help?
Well, they were around, but of course the train had moved some mm-hmm. some distance, and my father ended up having to carry his brother dying for you know some length of track. That
what a story!
Yeah, and it was a story
what
that
experience.
Well, it was something that I could never have imagined happening to anyone I knew. And then
growing up in the United States,
of course, mm-hmm. of course. And then on top of that, amazed that my father had experienced this. My father was a very placid, gentle...
Now, American psychiatrist.
Yes, a soft-spoken fellow. Never, ever expressed any clue to me, any hints at all of any sort of trauma in his life.
You hadn't known this story growing up as a boy, a young man? When did he tell you?
No, I found this out when I was in college in the course of doing an essay about the Korean War. And because I knew his age, I knew that he had been there
had
at the time.
Had to be there,
yeah.
Right. No one who was in Korea could avoid it.
I innocently asked him, you know, what his what his memories of it were. And finally, he told me this little tale, just an incident, in about three or four sentences. He didn't really get into any details, and he hasn't since. Wow. And we haven't really talked about it since. But that incident stayed with me, haunted me for, you know, forever. I think I'll always have it, and I decided to write a fiction around that.
When your son is a novelist, three sentences can turn into the seed of a novel. I wonder if you'd read right from the beginning with your father's story in mind, of he and his brother, the train, his brother's death there. Here's the opening couple of paragraphs of Chiang Rai-li's novel, The Surrendered.
Yeah. Of course, in this book, the heroine is named June.
A girl.
Yes.
She's 11 at this point.
The journey was nearly over. The night was unusually chilly, the wind sharpened by the speed of the train as it rolled southward through the darkened valley. The cotton blanket June had stolen was large enough to spread as a tarp and at the same time wrap around her younger brother and sister and herself. But it was threadbare, and for brief stretches the train would accelerate and the wind would cut right through to them. It had not been a problem the night before, but now they were riding on top of the boxcar, as there was no more room within any of them, even as the train was more than a dozen cars long. A massive phalanx of refugees had met the train at the last station, and in the time it took her siblings to relieve themselves by the side of the tracks, they had lost their place and had had to climb the rusted ladder between the cars, June running alongside for 50 meters until her brother was high enough on the rungs so she herself could jump up and on. There was a score or so of people atop every car, groupings of families and neighbors, mostly women and the old and the young, and then a cluster or two like theirs, children traveling by themselves. June was 11. Hee-soo and Ji-young had just turned 7. They were fraternal twins, though looked as much alike as a sister and brother could, only the cut of their hair distinguishing them. June knew they could have waited in the hope of another train with room inside, but it hadn't been cold when they stopped just before dusk, and she decided they ought to keep moving while they had the chance. To keep moving was always safer than lingering in one place, and there was nothing back at the depot to eat anyway. There were a few scruffy soldiers drinking and playing cards by the depot shack, though their presence could only mean trouble, even for a girl her age. She was tall besides, and she was wary of soldiers and any stray men. They were some 200 kilometers south of Seoul, past Chungju, and June was now thinking that they would make their way down to Busan, where her uncle's family lived, though she didn't know whether they were still there or even alive.
Chiang Rai-li reading from the very opening of his new The Surrendered. There's Korea, 1950, in June, 11 years old, on top of a train like his father was with his brother. In real life here, turns out her mother and other sister are dead. Her brother's been taken prisoner. Her father presumably shot. She and two siblings are all there is left at this point, and it doesn't last long, of the family. Tough, tough kind of circumstances opening right away from the Korean War. The Forgotten War, as Chiang Rai-li says. We're going to hear a lot about this book and your perspective. We've got callers with this experience as well. Nancy in Framingham, Massachusetts. Nancy, you're on the air with Chiang Rai-li.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm just calling to say that my father was a naval officer and aviator from 1943 until the end of 1955, and from 1950 to 52. He was not involved. He was an officer and a servicer in that time, but he was flying out of Florida over the North Atlantic, and I was a first grader. I was in kindergarten and first grade during that period. And in the first grade, this was 1951 to 52 school year, I was first made aware by my teacher that there was a war in Korea, and it made me sad and gave me a feeling of not despair, but of hopelessness and helplessness, because I was bringing a dime to school every week to buy a stamp for a war bond, maybe $25 worth. And in the spring of 1952, at the end of the first grade, I remember the whole class and I packed boxes, Red Cross boxes for refugees in Korea, and it left me thinking, you know, is this going to be appreciated? Is this going to make any difference? Is this going to do any good? And to this day, I have a feeling of kind of hopelessness and helplessness when it comes to warfare.
From that experience as a girl with your father off at sea in the Pacific, I mean, Chang Wei-Li, here it is. This was vivid and in the face of all Koreans, but it was vivid in the face of a lot of Americans as well, whether they were daughters of troops off to war or the soldiers themselves in Korea. This was a brutal experience for everyone, and your book gets fully into all that.
Yeah, last night I gave a reading from the book, and an elderly Korean gentleman said that he read this first scene where the children are on top of the train, and afterwards he came up to me and said, I hadn't remembered my own experience of that exact thing for 60 years. I hadn't actually wanted to recount it to myself, but reading and hearing you describe that scene brought me right back, and for the entire day today, I was thinking of that moment. So he had been on top of a train as well. Many refugees, it turned out, had moved out, you know, moved about this way. And so it's an experience that's not, of course, it's wholly visceral and emotional. There's no explaining it. And as you said, it echoes long, but it echoes deep.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Chang Wei-Li about war and its long, long echo. In his latest work, The Surrendered, I've got some pretty stellar reviews here. The Boston Globe says it's a harrowing tale, often bleak and distressing, and that's certainly true. Examines the unfortunate human aptitude for barbarity and betrayal, but also extols our determination to survive. And in some sense, by the end, alongside all the pain and horror that's in this book, that's the last thing standing, that determination.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to simply write a book about the horrors of war. I don't know that would be a book. I mean, obviously, that could be instructive and emotionally moving, but really, my aim for this story was not to talk. Obviously, I had to describe trauma, describe conflict. But what I really wanted to explore was the nature and condition of the human soul afterwards, and to think about how someone would go about persisting. And that was a word that kept coming up at me during the writing of this book and the thinking about this book, is an idea of persistence. All these people, these three characters that I follow primarily in this book, they all have reasons not to do so. They all have reasons for you know, eternal self erasure. But there's some other force in them that they're in control of and not that just keeps them moving forward and keeps them. I don't know that it's always hope. You know,
More elemental than that.
Yeah, I think it's much more elemental. For me, so much about this, my exploration of these folks was almost an exploration of the physical. There's such a viscerality to each of these characters that I thought somehow expressed those wounds that you're talking about.
Would you be good enough to introduce us to just those three and give us some sense of what brings them so close to self-erasure? What would justify practically self-erasure in your narrative?
Yeah, well, the one...
We met June, 11 years old at the beginning, 1950, traveling with her two brothers across a devastated Korea where vast columns of refugees are everywhere.
Right, and but the present time story involves her...
present time, I'm sorry to interrupt, but because it jumps back and forth and back and forth in time.
Yeah, the present time story involves her at the age of 47, and she's dying of cancer.
In the United States.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. And she's met back in Korea at the orphanage where she was staying after losing her family. She met a former GI named Hector, Hector Brennan,
a veteran of the Korean War.
Yes, and Hector is one of these folks who is struggling with persistence. He's someone who, in the course of his life, has figured out that somehow he's the cause of misfortune and doom for others.
He came back from the war. The memories, the experiences were terrible.
Yes, and also before the war as well, I think he felt as if perhaps he was someone who, would be the auger of some terrible things for others.
And even though you've given him this kind of superhero name, Hector, from ancient days.
Yeah, I like the word the name Hector because it plays upon, of course, the noble hero.
Mm-hmm. Who thinks he's trailing doom behind him.
Yeah,
in this case.
But in this case, I saw him as the anti-hero, someone who is ignoble, someone, and not from things that he's done, but more how he considers himself.
Mm-hmm. And then there's June, who goes from the girl in the midst of war, losing practically everything, terrible experiences, makes it to the States, and then there's the daughter of, the story goes back even further than the Korean War, Japanese-occupied China, Manchuria.
Yes. And there's an aid worker in the orphanage named Sylvie Tanner, who's the wife of the reverend who...
This is an orphanage in Korea, but she's been the daughter of Christian missionaries earlier in China.
In China, and in that storyline, the Sylvie, as a girl, experiences some horrible acts and the murder of her parents.
Her family at the hands of the occupying Japanese there. So it's like dominoes, the emotional toll of one war crashing into the next.
Yeah, well, that was one of my aims, was not to write a discreetly Korean war, a book discreetly about the Korean War, but a book about wars across time and trying to identify the commonality of those wars, particularly as expressed in the individual anguish and suffering of these people.
Let's get a hero for your American actor in this war, Hector, your anti-hero, as you have it. There's a scene from during the war. He's an American GI fighting there, and it is just as rough and barbaric, as the word comes up here, as it gets. After a dispute with another soldier in his platoon, he's reassigned to the Graves unit, where he's working to find and retrieve dead bodies, chipping them out of frozen ground, pulling them in all states of fresh death or deep composition. And he actually comes to favor this work over the bloody work of battle.
He sometimes somehow sees that it suits him. In some ways, he says he's afraid of blood, fresh blood.
But
there's something about the body that speaks to, I think, the darkness in his soul, this body handling.
It's rough. Even the rotting flesh of his maybe one-time comrades. Could you read a bit for us?
Oh, sure. Hector could never quite inoculate himself against the sight of blood, and he readily volunteered to do the very worst tasks, gaining the respect and appreciation of the other men, though it was secretly to avoid that certain hue, that crimson brightness. They called him the Prim Reaper, though chummily, judging him to be a little crazy as he knelt over some headless, legless, armless torso, probing with chopsticks or needle-nose pliers or with his fingers to see if the dog tags had somehow descended into the flesh. They couldn't know that he'd rather deal with the horror of a rotting body visibly shifting and radiating a sickening warmth from its hold of maggots than with that clean, red proxy of life. It was that blush still in the skin, in the eyes, that residual vitality of someone just dead or killed that always shook him to his bones. Life was too fearsome. At least the long dead were dead, if fouled and base, their forms a mere figuration of the inevitable, just flesh collapsing, denaturing into nothing but unsung mud and dirt. It was mud and dirt he was lifting, bagging, collecting with his bare hands, and he could simply wash it off afterward, though having to clean carefully under his fingernails, scour them with a tuft of steel wool dipped in kerosene to rid the most resistant notes.
Incredible scene from The Surrendered by Chiang Rai-Lee reading there. You talked about the persistence of people, of your characters, going on, surviving, you know, living on despite all their memories and the emotional baggage came with that. But what about the persistence of war and experiences like this themselves in people's life, the thing that just you just can't wash away, the thing that even decades or maybe centuries later is still at work.
Sure. And, you know, during the writing of this book, you know, this book took a long time. I started it in 2005. And, of course, during all that time, we've had our own wars here. And one of the things that I think informed me in the writing of this book, of course, I'd done a lot of research about Korea and the war itself there. Mm-hmm. But to read daily stories and reports from our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is just terrifying to me. And I'm a pretty keen reader of the newspaper, and I remember one story in which it talked about a soldier in a Humvee with his buddy, and one second they're just joking, and another second there's an explosion, and he looks across the seat to see that his buddy has no more face. Mm-hmm. That it's just gone. Mm-hmm. And the whole article was about the soldier who had come back and how he couldn't do anything but see that face, and that it loomed in his consciousness, right at the forefront of it. And that's those are the kinds of things that I think, you know, it can inevitably become inured to if we hear about it so much. But I think all of us in this country have been fairly intimate with war and carnage and suffering particularly in these last 10 years. And I think it should remind us about what's happened across history, of course.
Intimate in a sense, and yet many of us distant at the same time. And those terrible moments for individuals and for those nations can just slide by as headlines while we're off to the mall, even though their consequences will go on, as you say, a long time. We have lots of callers for you. Chiang Rai-Lee. Tracy in Fairfax, Virginia. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Lee. I just wanted to comment. My mother-in-law is from North Korea. Her name is Sun Jiao Kang, my wife, Suki. But she's the mother-in-law, she just passed away, but she was an extremely serious woman, very small, powerful. But regarding her family, when she was coming down during the Korean War trying to escape, just about everybody that was with her was killed. She had a couple of brothers that couldn't get out, and she was a young teenager. And hearing a very few stories from her was not a popular topic any time with her, but... I'm a photographer, and I've had a lot of trips to Korea. About 15, 16 years ago, I had two separate trips into North Korea, and I had the opportunity to be, I think the hotel we were in was called, there's only one place they put foreigners, it was called the Koryo, I think. But there was one phone in this one room where you could go, and everyone would watch you, you'd make the call. So I figured, I'm going to call Sun Jiao. So I called her. I think I woke her up. I don't know the time difference. I said to her, I'm in North Korea. I'm going to put somebody on. And wherever you go over there, you have these handlers that watch you. And so I put this guy on. We called him Sonny. That's what he said, call him. Yeah, I'm sure it was a different name. But I put him on the phone, and she's talking to him. I hear it start off, and I could hear her just start weeping and telling him all this stuff. And he looks at me, and he's just like in disbelief, you know, that I put this woman on. And they talked for about 10, 15 minutes, and he was writing down names. And she wanted him to try and see if either of her brothers in these villages was still alive. And it was a very surreal moment to hear her on that phone talking to him, you know, somebody in North Korea, and, you know, trying to ask and find out what happened to her brothers. But I just wanted to say that comment.
I appreciate that, Tracy. I appreciate it very much. And that conversation, no doubt, spanning not only half the planet, but decades, years. I mean, taking her back, maybe even her unburdening herself to a stranger who happens to be back where she had been when all the bad stuff
happened. They hadn't even brought up what happened to her. Just the the reference to the place. And that's how powerful it is. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was, you know, to write such a book and to focus on the aftermath of war, I needed to obviously show the trauma. But I wanted
It's traumatic. There's torture. There are things cut off you don't want to hear about.
I don't want to get into it because it was very difficult to write. Mm-hmm. But one of my aims was to try to put the reader in that place and time without that much intellectual, you know, scaffolding or straight, you know, I tried to go straight at some of the very difficult things that happened and tried to present those so that the reader could experience them almost without a filter.
So let me ask you this then. Have you come to think that human beings are shaped in such a way that we can carry those experiences, carry war in our backpack, and be healthy, or are we forever wounded by war?
Well,
period.
I think most people actually do carry it around quite well. My father did, and probably the tens of thousands of other people who've survived conflict and horrors, and they go about their lives and do their work. In some ways, it probably helps them do their work. You know. The caller mentioned how what a tough and sort of willful woman his mother-in-law was, and that doesn't surprise me at all. Part of what I explore in the book about June is how willfully stubborn she is, what a hard and difficult person she is.
Mm-hmm. The girl born of war, come up through it.
Yeah, and not totally determined by what happened to her, but maybe exposed also that the war clarifies her.
When you, I don't know how much time you spent in Korea at this point. I mean, your life is in the United States, has been since you were three. But do you see in Korea, in the Koreas, a war-tempered people's countries? Is it elemental to the Korean character at this point, this war?
I haven't spent that much time in Korea, just on visits. But I must say to you, and we were talking about this last night with the crowd, So many Koreans of that generation who've gone all over the world in the diaspora, they are some of the most capable, unrelenting, stubborn, can-do people that you'll ever meet. And I can't believe that that's some kind of genetic thing. I think it's partly because of recent history, of what they had to see and do. And that's always what's so shocking to me about that time, is that you see most of these people and they live perfectly ordinary lives, just as my father did. Mm-hmm. But to know that they'd had that experience frames it in a way that is startling.
You take us into war in ways that I hadn't quite seen. There's a scene where refugees are huddled in a house, there's a rainstorm outside, people are talking, they start talking about what persimmon trees and pear trees and whether there will be fruit. And a young man stands up and says, you know, how can you be talking about things like this? Don't you know there's, you know, rampant lawlessness and killing and raping? And an older man responds quite sharply that, you know, what are they supposed to do? They're powerless. They're just living. The older man says, war brought a tide of blood and it has swallowed everyone. You know, what can we do? The younger man hears the eternal debate, but it doesn't mean we should so quickly give up our humanity when you're in the midst of it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Chang Rae Lee about war and its long echo in his latest work, The Surrendered. Let's get a call from Janet in Brighton, Massachusetts. Janet, you're on the air with Chang Rae Lee.
Hi, Tom, and Maestro Chang Rae Lee.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, we are. Hi.
Okay. I've been a reader of you, Mr. Is it Mr. Lee? Mm-hmm. And I was especially taken with the Just Your Life. I found it one of the very saddest books ever written, stayed with me forever. That father so warped emotionally. And so I was looking forward to reading The Surrender. I would read anything you wrote.
Oh, thank you.
I'm calling as the child of a Korean War veteran also. to give maybe a perspective that isn't so often given about a different kind of war wound. The war wound of the children of soldiers who are supposedly noble and heroic. And so this is briefly my story. I was aged 3 or 4, and when my father enlisted in the Korean War, he had briefly been in World War II and was sorry that he was too young to really be in the thick of it, and thought of that as the best time of his life, quote. And then, so he enlisted in the Korean War, even though he had a pregnant wife and 2 babies, mm-hmm. me and my one of my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
What happened when he did that is my mother went pretty much off her rocker with anxiety about money and with anger, I think, looking back on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that she almost lost the house. All I knew was that my father wasn't there. He had abandoned us somehow. I had no idea what was going on. And I knew I was left alone with this angry, crazy woman.
And that was your life. That was your childhood.
That was my childhood. And so I always teased sort of my father later that he's responsible for my being terminally insecure because of that.
Janet, let us pick it up there, if we may. Chang Wei Lee, I mean, refugees of many kinds in war, even far from the war scene in a way.
Well, the ripples go on and on and on, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we're hearing that right now about fractured families of soldiers who had gone on multiple deployments, coupled with a difficult economy, people without health insurance. I mean, it ripples. And, of course, all the consequences of that are purely human consequences, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Dysfunction, abandonment, alienation, anger.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when there are children involved, characters are reformed in ways that aren't so glorious.
And yet we persist, or try to, your characters do, with lots of setbacks along the way. And I was curious about this. You know, you mentioned persistence, a kind of survivor instinct, hanging in there no matter what. It's, as you say, something more elemental than hope. But there's more than one scene in the book where it can seem as though war's very point is to try to extinguish that sense of persistence. There's a terrible scene, and I won't give it all, but in this, all the way back in, this is Manchuria, 1934, and there's a Japanese officer, read a Boston Globe review that went straight at this point. He's brutalizing his prisoner in your book, believes that pain begets truth. This officer believes, as the Globe reviewer says. He tells his victim, "You are a worthless human being. Do you hear me? Less than that. Not even a rat, a piece of dung. You are nothing. You will make no difference. You will not be remembered." And then all the horror comes. But it seems his point is to extinguish that persistence.
Mm, yeah. The grindstone of history is a very fine one. And there's nothing left often. I mean, we try, of course, we'd like to think that there is some larger reason, some larger hope or redemption. But the truth of the matter is, beneath that grindstone, there often isn't any redemption. People are obliterated. There aren't any hopeful stories. And that's, I think, one of the things that we have to remember about mm-hmm. about war. And you know, my novel does have, I think, a sense of, I don't know, I guess, I don't know about hope, but again, an awe at life, an awe at that kind of human struggle. I didn't want to prettify it. I didn't want to try to suggest that these great, great, profound forces were not, weren't anything but everlasting.
Horrible,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Here's a comment from a website from Caroline. She says she's a former journalist, fiction writer, deeply interested in the way of telling stories. The way telling stories can maybe help save a life. She asks, does Chang Wei Lee have any comments on the need to speak out truths, to not bury them, And now that in itself might be healing for all concerned. Are you looking to facilitate healing here, or is it something else?
Well, I wouldn't say that I wrote this book for that purpose. But you know, with all the books that I write, I think any writer, I mean, the kinds of things that they want to look at, or you know, they want to connect with some kind of vision, express it with some poetry, and ultimately speak some truth. And the truth, I think, ultimately is healing, only because it's so laid bare that there's nothing else around it. I think that recognition, the final recognition of what's elemental, what's true, that's the power of fiction. But it's not, you know, again, it's my aim and my intentions aren't therapeutic. If they are in the end, I think it's only because you know, I or some other writer has touched upon a core of truth.
Jules in Boston. Jules, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? I only caught part of the conversation here with your guest, and mm-hmm. I was struck by one thing where he was talking about the people who go on with their lives and where you don't necessarily even know about the experience they had. And something that I find interesting is that...
is this Jules Crittenden? Jules, is this Jules Crittenden?
That's right.
So you've been in the midst of war in Iraq, most recently as a journalist, embedded there. We talked with you back in the day when you were in the midst of all that fighting, Jules.
That's correct. And then a year later, I did a somewhat traumatized essay for you about the experience. Mm. But this is the thing is that has struck me is that we approach this almost exclusively in terms of disease or disorder nowadays. And well, there's no doubt that you know, war experience almost at any level, as one friend of mine put it, who went through historic experience or horrific experiences, put it, is 15 minutes is all it takes. But I think something that is not appreciated is that historically, and your guests seem to indicate this, trauma is the norm rather than the exception, and I think that our lives nowadays are sheltered enough that we may not fully appreciate.
What should we take away from that, if that's true, Jules? War, no problem, so what? Here we go, human life is trauma?
I don't think that that's the case at all, but I think that there may need to be a recognition that, A, trauma is part of life, that humans are at some level the reaction to stress is part of the human body and the human mind adapting to that it may be a maturation process rather than something that is strictly damaging, because life is not easy, life is not pretty, it involves loss, death, violence, all of these things. And
Jules, we will chew on that hard, but let me just ask you once more before we do, what does that say to you about war then? That we shouldn't be so upset about it? Go on, make it. Life is hard. Life is not easy. Is that what you're...
Well, I think that what we've found in the current era is that, you don't necessarily get the choice of evolving beyond it or advancing beyond it. As the military says, the enemy gets a vote in that. So I think that perhaps there needs to be in some quarters a recognition that there are times when that is the necessary evil. But that doesn't mean that you necessarily go into it blithely or gleefully by any stretch.
Jules Crittenden, who's been there, I thank you for calling in. Chang Wei Li, what are you thinking as you listen? Trauma is part of life, so. Good Lord, when I read the trauma in your novel, it's not. I hope it's not part of the life of it. You would never wish it on anyone, pulling rotting bodies out of the earth, and that's just the beginning.
Yeah, and I don't think Jules is saying that, you know...
Well, it comes with war.
It does come with war. I don't think he's a proponent of war, clearly. I'd like to step back and just think it's not... this anvil of war and history that crushes us It doesn't come about by accident. Mm-hmm. It's not a hurricane. Mm-hmm. It's not an act of God. Mm-hmm. In the classics, of course, it was an act of God, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the gods would argue their whims, and depending on what they wanted, men would suffer mm-hmm. and do crazy things to one another. But of course, that's not the case now. I mean, we control our destiny. We're the ones, and we meaning politicians, our leaders, our populace, in our silence and accommodation of the kinds of strategies and policies of our government. And we are the ones who are at the helm here. And I think that's, for me, that's ultimately one of the things that I was trying to figure out. Is it really history? You know, history is not, we try to think about history as this great faceless, anonymous force.
Ocean rolling over
yeah,
us.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But in fact, the truth about it is history is made by all of our efforts.
Well, if we're at the helm, let's steer away from some of the stuff you're conveying, for heaven's sake. Baltimore, Maryland. Chris, you're on the air with Chang Rae Lee.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Lee.
Hello.
I was wondering if you might want to speculate a little bit, given, you know, segue into the historical context of the war and its brutality. If there'd be a different Korean society today in North Korea, had certain things gone differently, for example, Mr. MacArthur, who was living fairly large in Tokyo, and he basically ignored pleas for help. Our troop readiness was way down. Troop levels were way down. In the meantime, millions and millions of Chinese troops were amassing on the border. And would there be a different outcome to the war and the result of the war?
Interesting. Chris, thanks for calling. And sure, I've dined in that house. MacArthur's house is the U.S. ambassador's house in Tokyo now. Maybe he was living large there, but he ultimately was hailed for the way he handled, ultimately, at least Incheon and all that piece of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But could this, you were just saying we're at the helm. Well, here's a test. Could this have been different? Did Korea and the Americans who engaged there and the Chinese who engaged there have to suffer all that? Could it have been different?
Well, of course it could have been different, and the geopolitical ramifications would be profound, of course. But we can't change that. I don't know that there would have been a huge difference in the amount of suffering, actually.
If what?
Well, I can't believe that there still wouldn't have been sustained conflict, sustained, you know, carnage.
If the South had just surrendered, if America had just sailed away, if an American victory had come more quickly, something.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know at the time that America would have ever surrendered or given up. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would have been the case. If they had given up at one point, I have to believe they would have gone in again, given the political considerations.
But that sounds like a peninsula doomed to the kind of pain you've visited upon it here.
Yes, absolutely. So I don't know that. I think it's a site of history that that was destined to be run over and over and over again. And I'm not saying that there'll be another conflict there, but there's clearly troubles.
I wanted to ask more, and we're nearly out of time. But let me ask you now: does it matter that you are a Korean American telling this story? Do you see that? And you grew up in a household where Korean was spoken, where your parents had lived most of, you know, their lives in Korea. You were here from very early on, but yet you carry that cultural awareness with you. Does that bring a different telling of this big palette story of war?
I'd like to think that anyone could have written this any artist and serious writer could have written this story. I do know, though, that that I have a very elemental and deep emotional connection to the material that I didn't really have, surprisingly, in the same way with my other novels. Those other novels are intellectualized, very aesthetically mm-hmm. intricate and interested and passionate, but emotionally not as deeply engaged as I was in this novel.
Our time is short, but you have Korean characters here, American characters here. As you contemplated all this, did you see them as human beings with different responses to war culturally?
No,
or
I didn't,
universal?
No, I didn't see them as having different responses at all. I thought because of culture.
Mm-hmm.
They had different responses because of their different consciousnesses and psyches,
mm-hmm.
And histories. So I wanted to uphold that idea about the individual and individual legacies having particular expressions. But, of course, I think the cultural angle and the cultural connection is mine. And maybe some of the sensitivities that I would have, that I had just over the years, helped me write the book.
Cheng Wei Li, author of The Surrendered. You can read an excerpt from The Surrendered at our website, onpointradio.org. Cheng Wei Li, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Kelly Horan, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Shireen Jafari and Case Wickman. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.